from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the Bob Directs production of Hair.
I'll talk with author John David Anderson about his new young adult book.
And I'll find out about the Museum of Bad Art exhibit at Garfield Park. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. It's been a long time since the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, so Sharon Gamble invited Bob Harbin to come to our studios to talk about why he's mounting a production of the 1968 Broadway smash hit Hair this July.
I love the line on your promotional postcard. Summer wouldn't be complete without music, love, and a hint of revolution. Some things don't change through the decades.
No, and thank goodness. Thank goodness for a little bit of familiarity as we go along.
Indeed. All right, so you were pretty young when Hair first came out.
Well, not as young as not as young as the cast, who none of them were born. I was in high school.
Yeah. Do you remember first reading about it or hearing about it?
I do. Those of us in high school that had a theatrical flair, there was a magazine published in New York, and called After Dark.
Uh-huh.
And it was a magazine dedicated to the arts, and every once in a while, you know, there'd be a ballet dancer, male or female, with fewer or less clothes, go, oh my God, look what's on in New York.
Cheap thrills.
But there was great news of it there, of course. And we were all a part of it, even whether we wanted to be or not. I remember, and I was telling this story to the cast, that the show was out in late 67, 68,
mm-hmm.
And in 1970 was when they had the first draft by lottery,
mm-hmm.
if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all in high school, and I think you feel many times so protected and sheltered in a high school environment. And yet here, all of a sudden, there was no shelter. There was no protection. We actually had a party, and we called it a party, where the guys all got together and to hear the drawing. And it was all very
That's chilling to think about.
Dramatic until one of our good friends was number three.
Ugh. Hey, for, you know, we're going to have listeners who don't know how that worked. Say a little bit more about how the draft worked.
At that, they were trying to come up with a fair way to draft people that was not, what can I say? That was not selective. That's not the right word. It was fair right across the line. There was no special cases, no matter what. Because when they drew numbers, they were drawing numbers by the day of the year. So if they drew, you know, number three was, you know, October 31st or mm-hmm. something like that. So mm-hmm. You couldn't get out of it. You couldn't be a special case. It was all done by birthday.
Right.
So his birthday was chosen as three. And the party went out of it. It became so very real to all of us at that moment. And unfortunately, he was drafted and he did pass.
And
during the war,
and that was there was such a one-to-one correlation. You go to Vietnam, you're not coming back. And of course, many people did. But if you were an 18-year-old kid,
the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. If you were found to be positive, you die. You just don't know when.
Yeah.
And it was the same feeling. Yes, that if you're going, and if you go, you probably won't come back, or you won't come back in one piece.
Yeah. So you have a young cast because the characters are young. The characters were teens or 20-something,
right,
in the, most of them in 1968. So did you send some of your cast members to do a little homework assignment to talk to their parents or their aunts and uncles,
know,
or their grandparents?
They have been
depending.
So terrific about this. There's been a wonderful CNN had a documentary about the 60s,
mm-hmm,
that started last week. So we're taping those and watching,
oh, cool,
those together. There's a documentary that was made about the show and the making of the show that's all about the 60s. We've done that together. And more importantly, I've asked all of them to go to their fathers and mothers and ask, what do they remember?
Mm-hmm.
What story comes to mind? And the stories have been phenomenal.
Really?
Some of the kids that says, my dad never talked about going to Vietnam.
Really?
He's never talked to me about being there or coming home. And we, and this particular woman, she said, we sat for hours and he just told stories one after another. And just, it was phenomenal to have that connection with a parent that hadn't been there before.
One of the biggest, and this is so enormous, one of the biggest shifts between a society with a draft and a society without a draft is, in a society without a draft, the people who join up not necessarily know what they're getting into, but have an intention to serve their country in the services. Whereas under a draft, if you're able-bodied and your number comes up, you go.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people who were constitutionally not even remotely prepared or willing or able emotionally ended up going.
It's almost too, like, now in many respects it is an occupational,
right, that's
option.
That's a great way to put what I was trying to say. Yeah,
if you don't have a job and you don't know what your prospects are, there is that opportunity,
mm-hmm,
that's there for you.
Or maybe you grew up in a family with a father,
exactly,
and a grandfather,
right,
or mother and grandmother who,
exactly,
served, and
right,
it's kind of in your family DNA.
Whereas at the time, and that's not to say that one is more important than the other, but you may have had a great education planned, or you may have had all these other things going on that just were cut short.
Mm-hmm.
Because the draft got in the way of that,
and I don't mean to. I just realized we've taken
it's
a very
ground.
We've taken a very serious turn here, and I do not mean to take away from the fun and the liveliness of Hair.
No,
because if you only know the Age of Aquarius or the song Hair, you're like, whoa, wait a minute, I had no idea how dark it was.
It
don't
is a
worry,
musical.
It is a musical, and there's a lot of fun,
and
there's
a lot
of liberation,
fun, a lot of silliness,
yeah,
a lot of craziness. A lot of under the influence activity.
Yeah, which this show is a big departure from you. You're often at this time of year working with kids on something like High School Musical, but this is not that, and this is for adult audiences.
Part of the promise of Bob Directs is to provide audiences with something different.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that something different is a production with young people that was written for young people. Or perhaps seeing, like we did with Form, with Claire Wiltshire in a wonderful role that is normally played by a man.
Right.
And to this year, I don't think the Hair has been seen here in Indianapolis for many, many years.
No.
And it's a tough show to do, but I think that so much of it is still, relevant and still important, and it's not just about the war; it's about race relations and relationships between men and women.
Free love.
free love. Do I actually need to dress at all for that? For that occasion,
so
lot of things that when you think back to Woodstock, it certainly was a lot of fun, as opposed to just being something that was out of the mainstream.
What's that saying I read somewhere recently? Like 1 in 10 people who claim they were Woodstock actually were.
Because
it was so groovy, you didn't, and I choose that word advisedly, so groovy, you didn't want to be left out. You had to go.
True.
So for generations listening to us or folks who maybe lived through the era but just never saw Hair back in the day when it first came out in the 67, 68, help me here, 68.
Right.
Yeah. What's the basic plot?
It's about a group of young people that call themselves a tribe. They exist together in a park, but probably like something like Washington Park in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
They have come together to protect each other, to be a different life set with each other. They've left home, they've left school, because all of those say establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time being, you know, establishment is bad. So they're out there on their own, taking care of each other and getting through life, trying to avoid the things that they don't like or that they think have been set up by previous generations that no longer apply to them. Hence, they have songs about Aquarius. Hence, they have wonderful songs about dropping in, dropping out. There are several references to smoking alternative substances.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is in the guise of, we want to put in your face what's going on that no one seems to be paying any attention to. And the only way to do this is to just smack it right in front of you. Here, I'm holding a sign. It's right in front of your face. You can't ignore it. You can't ignore me. You can't ignore the way I'm dressed. You can't ignore my behavior. You have to react to me. You can't be passive. You can't sit and not have an opinion. What I find interesting is that when I was growing up, I think most hippies were thought to be passive individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, we were much more involved in the political scene. And when I say involved, it wasn't just that we voted, but we actually did protest. We actually got out and made our opinions known.
Or knocked on doors and recruited people to a public servant you believed in.
And now we send emails.
Yeah.
You know, we send pieces on Facebook. If you believe in this, you know, share this with 83 other people, you know, and the heavens will shine upon you and you'll get rich. That's
so Hair is about what we did before a mouse click cleansed our conscience.
There you go. That's very well said. Very true.
What's the hardest part about staging Hair?
Trying to have some control over situations that had no control. People, they were moving, they were free, and you don't want to control that too much. You want to let the artists express themselves in ways that isn't the same as a normal musical where you have a piece of dialogue between three people and then a predictable song comes along and there's applause and then you jump right into a little bit of dialogue, a little story going forward and another song. I love those and would do them to the day I pass, but they're all so traditional and so predictable and of course there's comfort in that. This is completely unpredictable in the way it's written, in that you might have a song and then somebody else say something, go right back into something completely different. And it seems like a train wreck. But yet you have to kind of control it so it doesn't get out. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, no, I'm thinking, are some of your cast members who are used to those more traditional dynamics, are they like,
they don't
give
know
me a formula, I need
exactly.
help, I need structure.
Tell me what to do, tell me where to stand. I said, no, you just, you know, find why you want to stand there and come up with some of your own justification for that. These characters, they're called, many of them are just called the tribe. So there isn't a character description. So you have the wonderful ability to create your own person. And at the same time, that's scary as hell.
Sheer and Gamble with Bob Harbin. Bob's company, Bob Directs, is producing the 1960s American tribal love rock musical Hair at the Athenaeum Theater with performances July 5th through the 20th. Visit bobdirects.com for details and tickets. That's B-O-B-D-I-R-E-X, bobdirects.com for details. Or you can give a call to 317-280-0825. Again, 280-0825.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Author John David Anderson's last young adult book, Sidekicked, was about a group of eighth graders going to school to learn how to be superhero sidekicks. He's followed that up with Minion, a companion book that takes a good look at the bad guys. Travis DiNicola spoke with Anderson about the book.
John, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me, Travis.
You know, when we were here a little while back talking about your last book, Sidekicked, I believe I asked you at the end of the interview, what's next? And you said that you were working on not a sequel, but a book that sort of would work in tandem, part of the same world in some ways. Is that what Minion is?
Yeah, I guess you might call it a parallelquel.
Okay.
if that's, you know, a thing.
Okay.
I don't know if it is a thing.
Parallelquel?
It does, parallelquel. Mm-hmm. Say that five times fast. It does take place in the same universe, which
mm-hmm.
is cool.
Yeah.
But what it is in a lot of ways a photo negative of Sidekicked.
Okay.
Because as I was writing Sidekicked, the parts that interested me most were the morally ambiguous parts.
Yeah. Good and evil. And
yeah.
What happens when you do something for the right reasons, but it turns out wrong.
Right.
That was a big question you asked in Sidekicked.
Right. But at the same time, in Sidekicked, there was really never a question I didn't think that the main character, Drew, would stray to the dark side.
Yeah.
You know, how he got about, you know, defeating evil may be a little haphazard or backwards or awkward. But in the end, you knew he was a good guy. And even in the end, as I'm writing it, I knew that good would conquer all. And so these sort of things were left in my head unexplored about the nature of evil and, you know, straddling that line between right and wrong and the gray area of morality. And so I thought, well, what if I take this in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And instead of a sidekick, I explore it from the sort of the polar opposite, which is the Minion, who doesn't get enough attention, I don't think, necessarily in culture. I mean, yes, we have the little yellow guys with their banana affections and all these things, but the truth of the matter is we don't have a whole lot of Minions in our culture. And so I thought, take that and see where this character takes it. And, you know, how does this whole universe with superheroes and supervillains get viewed from the point of view of a character who is forced into a life of crime and villainy?
A reluctant Minion.
Yes,
and
he is.
You know, and before we get into all of that, I really want to talk about Minion. I mean, to give our listeners sort of a background, Sidekicked, and please correct me if anything I'm wrong here on, but basically it's the world, there are superheroes, there are supers, and most of the book deals with these young kids who are in eighth grade and they're going to school, and there's a special class basically that they get to go to that helps them prepare to become sidekicks. It's almost like an internship training program. And there's obviously a lot more to the plot, but that's kind of the basic world that they're in.
Right. I mean, they're part of Hero, and it's sort of masked as the Highview Environmental Reclamation Organization, right? So it's this environmental club. But then they escape into the basement of their school and they get to train to fight crime, you know, and supposedly they're training alongside their superheroes, but sometimes the superheroes fail them and so they have to band together as sidekicks and become heroes themselves. But the idea in Sidekicked is that there is still this support network very much in place. And so there's always something for Drew to fall back on. So even though he has questions of trust and loyalty, in the end, it's pretty clear cut, you know, who ends up on the good side and who ends up on the bad side.
Sure. Yeah. And in Minion, you don't really have that support network.
Not as much. No. I mean, in Minion, I think it's a lot more about family than it is in Sidekicked. Sidekicked is a lot more about friends and community and the sort of group that they form together, whereas Minion, you pretty much just have the main character and then his father, who's got his own issues, and they form their own network within a larger network, which has its own dark motives and everything.
Sure.
But what's interesting about it, I think, is that at the start of the novel, you don't even have really superheroes and supervillains per se.
Yeah, the town that they're in has sort of been abandoned by the supers.
It has, yeah. Right? New Liberty, the land without supers. And so when one does show up, mm-hmm. Without giving too much spoilers,
sure.
It completely throws off the dynamic that the whole entire town has had. And it throws off the dynamic between Michael, the main character, mm-hmm. and his father, and thrusts him into this world, you know, that Drew is naturally a part of and sidekicked.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to sort of see him in the middle, whereas we get to see Michael coming to it from the very beginning and having to adapt.
Mike's a really interesting character. You know, he does have a power. He's got the ability to essentially persuade people. If he can sort of look them in the eye, he almost kind of hypnotizes them and can get them to do what he wants, which leads to some interesting things, especially because he's raised in an orphanage, a Catholic boys' school orphanage, where he sort of has the run of the place for quite a while and uses his powers sometimes, not always for good. But, you know, I mean, there's a great scene that I was reading where, you know, he's with a buddy of his and they're at the mall and they see these two girls that they're just like, oh, God, they're so gorgeous, you know, and they go over and, you know, and he really is trying to refuse to use his powers to persuade this girl to like him. And he's trying so hard not to even, like, look her in the eye because he doesn't want to, like, accidentally somehow persuade her. And I think, you know, this guy's a good guy. I mean, you know, at heart, he's, you know, he's, I mean, yeah, okay, maybe a few pages earlier he was involved in a bank robbery, but, you know, still he's trying to do the right thing. I mean, the bank robbery was only because, you know, they needed some money for food and frozen waffles or whatever, right? You know, but it's a very interesting dynamic that, you know, and he's a pretty complex character.
He is. And I think what's interesting is, you know, Drew's code and sidekick is written on the back of the wall. He's got, like, point by point, you know, thou shalt and shalt not.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Michael, in many ways, has to construct his on his own.
Yeah.
And so this rule about when he can use his power, which, by the way, is infinitely cooler than Drew's power to be able to see and smell things, you know, from yards
right,
away.
Poor Drew.
Like, I actually made a protagonist that can do something now.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he sort of institutes this own code upon himself
mm-hmm.
about who he can use it against and who he can't and for what purposes.
Within reason,
mm-hmm. yeah. And so that's a lot of responsibility, I think, to thrust on somebody at that age.
Yeah.
Is to say, you know, you have this immense power. And on top of that, we're not going to necessarily outline for you the parameters by which you can use it, right? You
have to sort of figure really this out yourself. He's developed his own code. It's not even from... You know, his adopted father is this really interesting character, but, you know, I don't get the sense that, and I'm not finished with the book yet, but that, you know, his adopted father, who he calls his dad, you know, certainly is teaching him things and instilling, you know, morals in him, but maybe is not necessarily guiding him on how to use the power in that way, right?
Right.
He's kind of on his own to some extent.
Yeah, and one of my favorite scenes is when Michael sort of gets inducted into the world of his father,
mm-hmm.
And he's sort of standing at the top of the basement door, which is where the lair is, right? The lair's
the
in the basement.
Lair, yeah. Of course.
And he says, you know, once you open that door, his father tells him, you know, mm-hmm. that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to force you to open it
mm-hmm.
One way or another. You get to make that choice. And he makes that choice at a very early age, and so it's that autonomy that his
yeah.
father gives him, which is sort of a double-edged sword. And I think even by the end of the book, right, that's kind of the reason you're still reading,
mm-hmm.
is to see how he's going to, you know, what decisions he's going to make. So with Drew, it's more of a question of, you know, how are you going to beat the bad guy? With Michael, it's more of a question, are you still going to be a bad guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we get to the last page?
So I have to ask... you know, we've talked about Drew, who's the lead character in Sidekick, who his special powers basically is he can – all of his senses are quite heightened, so he can hear and see and smell things very well, which can come of use. But, you know, it's not as cool as lighting things on fire or
right.
turning into ice or being
right.
able to fly or something like that. You know, it's definitely provides for some interesting character development. Do you imagine at some point Drew and Mike ever crossing paths?
I would love to see
yeah.
that, actually, even though I think it's pretty clear who would win in a mano-a-mano fight, right? Because
mm-hmm.
Michael just looks Drew in the eyes.
So, hey.
But, you know, as I said, you know, Drew has the support network behind him, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Michael in many ways is in some ways on his own anyways. But I think what's interesting about the two novels together is when you create this universe with all these questions and these conundrums and moral complexities, what I think would be even more interesting is throwing a third character into this mix, right, who takes a completely different view than the two of them.
Yeah.
Maybe somewhere right in the middle, pulled by both of these forces, right, and see which way he or she goes. Like, that would be the direction I would love to take it.
Let me ask you a bit about sort of, I mean, this battle between good and evil and understanding that the characters are going through. Have you also, I mean, sort of gone through an exploration of this yourself as you've been writing these books?
Well, it's one of those things. I used to teach at the University of Illinois. And so, you know, when you get into these books and these weighty issues, and what I found is the books that teach best are the ones that ask the most questions, not necessarily the ones that give the most answers. And so as I've evolved writing these books, I think one of the things I've been doing is leaving more and more questions open-ended. And sort of just giving the tools or the vocabulary for readers to come at it and discuss it, you know, or engage in a conversation with the characters in the book, but not necessarily be given, you know, the fortune cookie recipe at the end, which says, you know, this is what good is, this is what bad is, and being able to sort of step back and say, all right, you know, I'm not going to answer that one for you as the author, because honestly, I don't know.
Well, I guess maybe sort of as a follow-up, I mean, have you found yourself, though, looking at maybe situations outside of these books where maybe in the past you have thought, oh, that's a good thing to do, and now you're like, I'm not so sure, or that's clearly a bad guy, or maybe not. Or...
Right, right. Yeah, I've always been a skeptic. I've always been able to sit on the fence and see it both ways, which, you know, has its detriments, and that sometimes you don't necessarily gird yourself up to be passionate about one thing, because then as soon as you do, you step back, but wait a minute, I probably should have, you know, that kind of thing. But as a novelist, anyways, it's cool because it allows you to explore all the different corners and angles, even the dark ones, where you kind of think to yourself, you know, as much as I want to be Drew, there are times in my life where I wake up and it would definitely be beneficial to stare somebody in the eyes and say, you know, give me my cable bill cheaper.
Wait, are you trying to hypnotize me right now?
Yeah, yeah. Look close, close into my eyes.
So you are clearly a fan of comic books, of superhero stories. I mean, there's a lot of fun sort of references. You're very playful with the language and the references in both books. Do you ever think about seeing these books illustrated?
Yeah, I would love to see them illustrated, provided that somebody with actual talent were to approach me about it. You know, it's one of those things. I would have loved to have been a picture book author myself, you know, if I had that, just because of the sheer economy of space and words, you know. But at the same time, part of the joy of writing novels is allowing, creating that space with language that allows the reader to imagine it as they would, you know, in their own heads. And so I do worry at the same time. I don't want to prescribe necessarily what this world looks like to the nth detail.
Right, right.
It's that imagination, obviously, that got me into reading, you know, and what my Prince Caspian looks like or my Harry Potter looks like versus anybody others. You know. So I think, yeah, it'd be cool to see it in any format, you know, be it film or TV, to see what somebody else does with it, you know, and turn it into something else. But it would never be the same.
Sure.
You know, it would never be my version. It would be their version of my story. And so I would always have, you know, the special connection to the vision I have in my own head, you know, as well as I described it.
You know, speaking of other books and just sort of a love of reading, I love that Mike's dad is basically making him do homeschooling, and which continues on into the summer. And one of his assignments is he's reading Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, which is just awesome for a minion to be reading, I think.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, and sort of his description of the book and what he's getting out of it, you know. And also at one point he sort of says, "Well, you know, I'd really just like to be reading some Harry Potter, but
honestly,
you know, but I got to read some Crime and Punishment."
Crime and Punishment, right? At the age of 13 or whatever it is, that's pretty heavy duty stuff. Yeah. You know, and his reaction is like, this guy gets off pretty easy considering what he does, you know. But that's spoiler alert for Crime and Punishment.
Well, there you go. Okay.
Maybe we shouldn't give that away for people who haven't read Dostoevsky.
But yeah, it's there's just some, like I said, I've really enjoyed both of these books a whole lot. I mean, I know that they are young adult, and your audience, I mean, you're really aiming more for junior high, high school
middle
students,
grade,
middle grade and stuff. But I'm just having a fun time reading them.
Well, thank you. And, you know, that's, I think, a lot of middle grade authors they've got that special position now, because you know the way that the entire field is sort of broadened out, and lots of people are taking an interest, that they can try to reach, you know, multiple audiences at once. And you know, young adult has been doing that for a while, where adults have been, you know, just absolutely immersed in it. But I think you're starting to see more and more adults that are sort of, you know, getting past their barriers or reading middle grade books and see, because asks a lot of the same questions that the adult book do, sometimes even more.
And reading them for fun, not just because their kids are reading them.
So hopefully that's a trend that will continue.
So since the last time I had you on the show, I asked you what's next. That's how I'm going to wrap it up this time. What's next for you, man?
What's next is actually a bit of a departure from this. Next summer, a book comes out called The Dungeoneers, which is more in the realm of high fantasy, hearkening back to J.R.R. and J.K. and all those people with initials after their names, right? C.S.
And
or before their names. And it's really sort of out of a love of kinds of Dungeons and Dragons-esque stuff, but with a really satiric, offbeat note to it. So it's fun, but it's also a little dark. And it's, you know, it starts with a boy who learns how to steal, and where that talent leads him, right? But you know, it's got all kinds of stuff. It's got barbarians, and it's got oozing slimes, and
all the good stuff.
It's got all the good stuff in it.
Cool.
Right?
That sounds great. John David Anderson, always a pleasure to chat with you. Really enjoy your books. And congratulations on the release of Minion, which is coming out right now as we speak.
All right. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Travis DiNicola with author John David Anderson. His most recent book is titled Minion, and it's a companion to his earlier young adult novel, Sidekicked. You can get more information at johndavidanderson.org, and I'm told they don't card you there, so if you're a grown-up and you want to read these books, you're welcome to. johndavidanderson.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know what's coming up this weekend? It's a special day that often involves cake.
Oh, your birthday.
It's my birthday
weekend. Happy
birthday, Sharon. Thank you. My birthday is this Saturday, June 28th.
How exciting.
Woohoo.
Well, I bet we can find some ways to celebrate your birthday on that calendar we call.
What do we do? What a fabulous idea.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking, what would be a fun thing for Sharon to do on her birthday? Maybe check out the opening of the 431 Gallery Show that is taking place at the Indiana State Museum and at the Heron School of Art and Design. That opens on Friday night, June 27th. It runs through September 14th. You've heard about it here recently on The Art of the Matter, and it's a big exhibit that they're basically rebuilding the entire 431 Cooperative Gallery that used to be located on Mass Avenue at 431 Mass Ave, and they're rebuilding it inside of the State Museum, and they're going to have a big exhibit at the State Museum about that gallery and how it really helped Mass Ave evolve as an arts district. And then there's also going to be an exhibit of Ed Sanders' work at Heron School of Art. And on Friday night, they're doing sort of a progressive gallery opening. But then after that, both shows will be open and worth checking out.
Love it. Hey, this Saturday at Book Mama's, Midwestern Gothic is presenting a reading, a special event. Midwestern Gothic was started in 2010, and it's based in Ann Arbor. It's a quarterly literary journal dedicated to featuring work about or inspired by the Midwest by writers who live or have lived here. And it aims to collect the very best in Midwestern writing in a way that's never been done before. So you can go online and check out Book Mamas and learn a little bit more about Midwestern Gothic and about that special event at Book Mamas.
Hey, if you're thinking about how am I going to spend the 4th of July? Where am I going to watch the fireworks from? Well, here's a really cool... nicely done,
practice with me.
Indie Fringe has a pretty good idea. And what they're doing is they're having a 4th of July party at Indie Fringe. And this way you don't have to lug around a lawn chair or fight for a viewing spot on Mass Ave. You can just show up at Indie Fringe because it's 6:30. They're going to have some of Indiana's favorite and famous Jugs Fried Chicken and Biscuits. And they're going to have one big long dining table with a great view of downtown's fireworks. Buffets serve from 6:30 to 8:30. It is going to be very, very, very family friendly. And they're going to have lots of fun food, and it'll be a great way to take your kids out and enjoy a little bit of Fringe as well while you watch the fireworks. Get your tickets now. Check out the Indie Fringe website for more information.
So you live or work near downtown Indy, and you're looking for a cool and elegant place to have dinner or tea. Think about the Propylaeum, and they have lunch in their signature tea room Tuesdays through Fridays throughout the year from 11 to 2. They also have afternoon teas Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays through the rest of the year from 3 to 5. So lunch 11 to 2, tea 3 to 5. They do want to know that you're coming if you're going to the tea, so give them a call at 317-638-7881. Reservations for tea at the Propylaeum, 317-638-7881.
Sounds good. Well, Sharon, that's all the time we have for today, but we will be back next weekend after celebrating your birthday.
Yay.
On that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Normally, The Art of the Matter tells you about high-quality art, but indulge us for a few minutes because Sharon Gamble was determined to find out why Indy Parks and the Garfield Park Arts Center were attracted to a partnership with the Museum of Bad Art. Here's her conversation with Elsie Benitez and Leslie Meyer.
So how did you first become aware of the Museum of Bad Art? Elsie, were you the one on the prowl for this?
Yes, I was. I've actually been following them for some time now, just as a, you know, interest to see what kind of museums are out there. And so I started following their Facebook, and they are regular updaters of new acquired pieces in their collection.
I think it was on their website that I saw a kind of a definition that included the words, but something went horribly awry or something like that. How would you define bad art?
For me, I think sort of their statement really resonates with me is the idea that artists are creating something very genuine and it's original content and they're going for an honest attempt at creating a beautiful piece of work. But that doesn't always work out. Sometimes there is a flaw in the plan. And so I think that that really shows in a lot of the pieces that they collect. You can see that there's an honesty in all of it, and it's not meant to just be bad, but it's sort of beautiful but also wrong for some reason.
And it brings up a whole kind of troublesome dynamic issue, because normally we celebrate artists and kind of stroke them and say, aren't you wonderful for creating mm-hmm. this gorgeous piece of art? Mm-hmm. And in this case, I mean, do we know how any of the artists who are in the permanent collection at MoBA feel?
From my understanding, the artists that are credited with their pieces are actually quite happy
to be
in that collection. And again, I think it goes back to just the intent of the artist when they're trying to create something. Even if it turns out wrong or there's a flaw in it, they're still happy that somebody's appreciating it.
Yeah.
And that it's being viewed. And it, you know, it's obviously not going to be a masterpiece and it's not going to make one of the great museums. But there's, you know, curators out there that actually care about what they're doing.
Sure.
And I think, you know, that will make them very excited to know. And also for us, we put out an open call for local artists
right.
that collect bad art and then also may just have some if they're an artist themselves. And there's been more responses from artists who sort of say the same thing. I've started this piece, it went wrong somewhere, but it was still kind of just too beautiful to throw away.
Wow. So mm-hmm. it's nice to be able to honor that intent mm-hmm. as well as kind of the product that came out at the far end.
Right.
Yeah. Leslie, was there any hesitation on the part of the Parks Department when you were like, oh, we're going to feature an exhibit of bad art
I
at
think
Garfield?
There was no hesitation in terms of content. the only hesitation was the money, because, you know, we're the Parks Department. And our challenges are usually budgetary. And then in the past, when we have looked for exhibitions to bring in, there are definite climate control issues related to light or humidity or security. And the Museum of Bad Art didn't have sort of the stipulations that the Smithsonian would. You know, when the Art Center opened originally in 2006, they brought in an exhibition from the Smithsonian that required just a high level of security and sure. insurance and humidity control. And MoBA does not have those stipulations.
Surprise!
So for us, that made it simpler. And it was more affordable in that. And when we talked about the summer and what we want to bring to the public during the summer, we want to create exhibitions that are accessible, because June and July and August are our highest peak of attendance.
Sure.
You know, we have more people that come through the building during the summer than at any other time of the year. And we're definitely, you know, a lot of times we're folks' first entry into a museum or gallery experience. So we like to have things that you can grab a hold of
yeah.
and get, and you don't feel like you're out of the loop or you can't appreciate it because you don't have some sort of esoteric knowledge, or you didn't go to art school, or you don't have someone sort of narrating your entire experience there. And I think this exhibition fits that bill really perfectly. You know, it's approachable, it's understandable, it's sometimes it's very humorous, sometimes it's serious. But anyone can come in and discuss it. And I think that's really important about this exhibition. And when Elsie brought this up and we talked about different funding avenues and what we could do, and the deadline got closer and closer mm-hmm. and we'd made some inquiries about some grant support, and we knew in our turnaround time it wasn't going to happen. And I finally said, let's just do it. We'll find the money. We'll figure it out. Let's
Good
just make
for
it
you.
Happen.
Good for
and
you.
So we made it happen, and it's gotten incredible response. I mean, luckily we sort of have that freedom with our tiny budget to make those decisions. And when we announced it, it got great response just from our region and amongst other Indy Park staff. So
I'm curious, I'm thinking about the other amenities at Garfield Park, mm-hmm. which has so much to do and see. Do families sometimes come in to see an exhibit after they've done something else? They've had a picnic, they've gone swimming or whatever, or are you seeing mostly, and maybe you don't have data about this, but are you seeing mostly people coming just to an exhibition?
I would say both and.
Yeah.
We definitely have exhibitions where people are showing up just for this particular show. In fact, we closed an exhibition of miniatures in May, and that brought in a very particular audience because they were really interested in miniatures. The Southside Art League hosts an abstract exhibition every September, and folks come in just for that exhibition. They're definitely there for that type of art. But I would say the majority of our visitors, 75% or more, are casual visitors to the park, people who've come for the fountains, people who are out at a picnic or walking. I mean, we still, even though the building has been open as an art center since 2006, on any given day, 90% of people that walk in, I didn't know this was here. What is this place? And usually they're looking for a restroom.
That's
Let's
okay.
Be honest,
whatever
and
brings them
say,
in.
You know what? You're welcome to use our restrooms. And please stop in and see the exhibition on the third floor while you're there so that you can see what we're all about. And then they always come downstairs with lots of questions. And can we come back? Is it free? And yes, the Art Center is absolutely free.
You know,
it's free for people to come in and spend the day.
And I need to point out, listeners, if you still have a little time the weekend you're hearing this interview, you can catch the tail end of the exhibit Hoosier Women in Art, which runs through this Saturday.
Yeah, yeah, and it is gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's a stunning exhibition, so come in for that.
So as we're having this conversation, Elsie has just gotten the shipment of the pieces of 20-some pieces from the permanent collection of the Museum of Bad Art. Have you had much chance to look at them yet?
I just unpacked them from the boxes. They're saran wrapped or bubble wrapped right now. And so I just got a slight glimpse to see what we have going there. And there's a lot of really interesting things. Super excited to unwrap everything and and really have a closer look at everything that was sent to us.
Mostly paintings, sculpture, anything else? Mostly paintings.
It's just 2D paintings, oil on canvas, watercolor, things of that nature.
Now, in your conversations with the Museum of Bad Art, did you have any leeway in, I mean, since you'd been following them on digital media for a while, did you say, could we get that painting? I really love that painting that you had in this post. Or did they just say, this is what we send when we're sending out a collection?
Well, there was some leeway with them. There apparently are quite a few bad art nudes, which we weren't able to show at our facility. So I asked the director to sort of hold back those in the shipment and just to send more family-friendly things. And then just one of their, I believe their signature piece, we weren't able to get a hold of because that's actually in Taiwan for an exhibition that just finished.
Strat.
Yeah. But they did send us some other gems.
Is the signature piece the one that's used on your postcard?
No, that's a different one.
Tell us about that one. It's a...
Yeah, I believe it's a chocolate chip queen. and it's a queen, apparently, who you can't see from that postcard, but she's wearing a beret. And she chose that instead of her crown, which is sitting right next to her. And she's holding a chocolate chip cookie.
And she's wearing garb that's vaguely 17th century, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep, definitely so.
And she's got a little Modigliani influence in her kind of misshapen face. I mean, sorry, artist, if you're listening, I don't think you are. But she's kind of got, but there's a simplicity about this composition that's really appealing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think the artist... sort of was able to capture the regalness of this woman. I think it really stands out.
And it makes you want to know how can I be a chocolate chip queen?
Well, I mean, it was a specific choice. That wasn't an error or, you know, oh, I got a black spot in the wrong place.
Right.
She's holding a chocolate chip cookie. So what's the story there?
Know.
That's what you're kind of curious about.
I want to read the children's book that has this character in it.
Yeah.
of the local pieces, do you have a favorite or two, either of you?
Those are actually still coming in.
Okay. Too soon to tell.
I can't decide just yet, but we definitely have some real winners.
All right, here's the real dirt. Have either of you ever made a piece of unintentionally bad art?
Oh, I think all of my art is bad.
What do you do? Do you paint?
But it's, I actually do not. I mean, just for fun, sometimes I will paint. But my background as an artist is in theater, so I in performance and teaching. So that's, I can talk about art really well. But I think, you know, I do remember back to my drawing days and drawing classes and trying to be an artist and being able to get so far in a piece and you just can't get the right shape. Like mm-hmm. I'm imagining a specific drawing that I did and I just couldn't get the right shape for a hat, no matter how hard I tried. And if I could find that, I would hang it because I think it's a perfect example. It's like I was working really hard on my shading and I had the composition, but I just couldn't get past seeing the hat as it was and mm-hmm. and trying to translate that on paper. I don't know if that makes any sense,
but
that was my sincere
sense.
Attempt.
Yeah. And there's, you know, that's so frustrating to be able to envision what it is you want to create and not be able to get there. Whether you're a visual artist or musician or dancer or actor, it doesn't really matter your art form. That gap between the ideal in your mind's eye and what you can do is like, it's like, what keeps you going, really.
Yeah, it's making that emotional connection, and sometimes we just can't get there. I mean, even as an actor, when you're in a role, maybe that's the missing piece, is that you just can't make that emotional connection. Maybe it's similar in visual art as well. I don't know.
Elsie, you think, Elsie? Bad art?
I don't know.
Have any in your portfolio?
I'm sure there's lots. I started doing photography in high school.
Uh-huh.
And when I look back on those years, it's very troubling. But in the years since, I really am interested in mistakes. So I still work with film, analog, you know, stuff. And I love where things go wrong, where you weren't sort of expecting it to show up this way, or there's a light leak or something. And so I think you know, the idea of what's bad and what's good, you know, is obviously really subjective.
Yes.
But sometimes bad is still beautiful.
Yes.
So.
Definitely so. Yeah. No, I think that's definitely true. And I think that's why, you know, in some respects, it's difficult to discuss this exhibition because you come out and say, oh, we have an exhibition from the Museum of Bad Art. And there's that sort of instinct to laugh and
of
go,
course.
Oh, it's awful. It's all so bad. But I don't believe that that's the Museum of Bad Art's intent. You know, their intent is to celebrate and love and support and hold up these works. And I think that's why it's such a great point of access for people and why we hope that they'll come in and participate in Arts for All and create a painting or a drawing and add it to the exhibition on the second level and have it on display and put their name on it and title it and be able to say, I had a work of art on display in an exhibition. So that's another goal for us is to get people in and creating. I can't tell you how many parents will come in with kids on the weekend and say, oh, I'm not an artist. I don't know where they get this creativity from. Mm. And whenever I hear that, my automatic response is, of course you're an artist. Sit on down with us. You know, Sarah, who's our art specialist, and she's in the art room a lot, she insists, you know, if you're in here, you got to make something. You know, let's create together and give it a try. And a lot of times they leave it. You know, the adults will leave them, or even the children who are reluctant will leave them, and we usually hang them up, you know, so even though those folks have left, we've put that piece on display, depending on the project, whether they know it or not.
Sharon Gamble with Elsie Benitez and Leslie Meyer. See 25 pieces from the Museum of Bad Art's permanent collection, augmented by submissions from local artists July 5th through July 26th at the Garfield Park Arts Center. And find out more at gpacarts.org. That's gpacarts.org.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when, for the 4th of July holiday, we'll revisit a couple of our favorite interviews from earlier this summer.
Plus, I'll chat with author Ben Winters about his new book, the final installment of the Last Policeman trilogy. And it'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.